I'm Laura Vinroot Poole. For 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store. Capital has never really been about fashion. It's always been about people. What we wore was created to share the meaningful journeys that inspire me. From the designers and friends I meet on the road to the men and women with whom I work each day.
Everybody wants to know her.
Cameron Silver, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. Where are you?
I am currently in Boulder, Colorado.
But you're not from Boulder. Can we tell the listeners where you're from?
No, I'm not from Boulder, but I've sort of spent, I think, 67 days here. We've been counting.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, I've been here for quite a while.
That would never be a place I would think. When they said you were in Colorado, I was thinking you were in Aspen. So
well, I've been to Aspen twice, and I'm going to tell you right tomorrow.
Okay. I didn't know you were a mad hippie. I mean,
my look has completely changed. It's a mix of like American Gigolo meets, you know, a mountain man.
I like it. It sounds great.
Yes, but I'm originally from Los Angeles. I was born in East LA and grew up in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. Only child, I think.
I am an only child, yes, for better and for worse sometimes.
I have one of those too. I think it's for better. I hope so.
It's complicated.
Yeah. And tell me, what was your first fashion memory, Cameron?
I'd say it was when I saw the movie Annie Hall. So as an only child, my parents took me to do everything. So I was seeing, you know, R-rated films as like a nine-year-old. But that film made an impression on me because I love the look of the fedora hat and the vest and the rolled up sleeves and the khakis and the undone tie on Diane Keaton. So I appropriated that look once, and my parents took me to Fred Siegel, and a star was born because every sales associate was so enamored with this, you know, nine-year-old. I think I was 9 or 10 at the time. And I realized the power of fashion to attract attention.
Cameron, you're really tall. Were you a tall little person too?
Not super tall, but I mean, I was tall for my class. I mean, I'm oddly tall considering my parents are little. So I was always long. But, you know, now I'm 6'3", and I guess if, you know, you put a fedora on a nine-year-old, it looks kind of tall.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking you probably look great in the clothes. Were your parents shoppers, or were they into clothes and style?
Yes, my mother continues to be a voracious shopper of questionable taste. You know, I think her fashion heyday was definitely like the mid-80s to mid-90s, so it was Sonia Riquiel and Azzedine Alaia and Claude Montana and Terry Mugler and Valentino and a little bit of Oscar. So that's when she was shopping, and my parents were much more social at that period. My father also has always liked beautiful things. I mean, he passed away, but he loved his Gucci loafers.
And I think you traveled a lot as a child. What did your dad do that took y'all on traveling so often?
Well, my dad was a personal injury attorney. So that wasn't the real reason for our travel. It was really because they loved traveling. And, you know, when you have one child, it's not so complicated and not so expensive. So they were fairly exotic travelers. So by, you know, when I was 3 and a half, we went to South America, which was quite unusual in 1972 and 1973 to be in Argentina and Peru and Venezuela, and I have very strong memories of that trip. And all of our travel always included shopping. So on that trip, I can remember buying a llama puppet named Pom Pom Bom Bom. And I'm sure my mother bought lots of kind of Guatemalan textiles that are probably in some drawer somewhere in the house.
Your mother being a shopper, I mean, was that, did you already see the value in holding on to important things, clothes and things from travel?
I don't know if my mother set that example. What I did realize is that, you know, finding pieces on your travels helped the memories be more intact. So, I mean, that's the amazing thing, that I remember Pom Pom Bom Bom at 3 years old. I also remember that my mother threw it in the washing machine and killed Pom Pom Bom Bom. So I've had tremendous trauma because of that, along with my blanket white. It's one of the childhood things I remember. But I did realize at an early age that I learned a lot about places I was visiting by what was local and what was made local. And still to this day, wherever I go, I like to shop local and I like to vintage shop locally. When I was in Hawaii last month, I was thrifting, looking for Aloha shirts. And I have enough now that I'll be doing a pop-up in Kona in May.
Cameron, you're also a natural entertainer. Were you like that as a child?
Yeah, I was totally performing constantly. My grandmother was a pianist and taught piano till the day she died. And it was not unusual for me to do recitals where my grandmother would play piano and I would sing, and then I would sign autographs to my grandmother's penny poker friends. But I also, you know, I took acting lessons in grammar school. In high school, I was president of Madrigals, and I was classically trained as a singer and actually got recruited to UCLA as a sophomore in high school as an actor. Wow. So my training was, you know, pretty serious in both classical voice and in theater. So I went to UCLA, but my career sort of segued away from theater. I continued to sing when I got out of college, but I did take costume design at UCLA and I found it incredibly inspiring and I was good at it.
I've also read that you did an album for Hollywood Records. I didn't know this. Tell me about this.
There have been so many careers. When I graduated UCLA in 92, I started to interpret the songs of Kurt Weill and the Weimar Cabaret composer Friedrich Holländer.
Of course you did.
Yes, of course. That's what everyone does. Obviously. And I was touring around the country and eventually recorded an album of the show that came out in 96 or 97, almost about the same time I was getting ready to open Decade. So I always say that I used to recycle old songs and then I started to recycle old clothes.
Had you done retail before? Like, when was it that you decided that fashion was something you wanted to pursue?
Well, I always worked retail. In high school, I worked at Fred Siegel, like every Beverly Hills kid. In college, I took a year off because I worked at Theodore and was making so much money that I like horrified my parents by taking a year off of school. And it was, at that time, Theodore was just amazing because they were selling Kenzo. They were the first to have Dolce & Gabbana. It was like Go Silk was like, you know, people would buy these Go Silk outfits for $1,500 and you buy three of them, you know, the jacket, shirt, and pants. I wish I kept all my Go Silk because it's sort of like how we're dressing right now. I remember there was Casa Bajac and People of the Labyrinths. Catherine Hamnett. So it was.
Oh, God, yeah.
So I was always interested in fashion, but what I really, really remember, Saturday mornings watching Style with Elsa Clench every Saturday morning at 7:30, and I would watch it with my mom and dad. I never got to appear on Style with Elsa Clench. I did get to appear with Jeannie Becker several times on fashion television, and actually a lovely friendship developed from that because Jeannie Becker's show was amazing. And I remember Tim Blank had a show also. Yeah.
All the Canadians.
So, and there was, a show called, was it La 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 or Rue La La? Another Canadian fashion show. The Canadians were really great with fashion television. So that was very traditional. And the other thing that I loved so much was the September big books.
Oh my God.
Magazines. And when they would drop into the mailbox and you could hear that thud. And truthfully, it was the first time most of us were seeing clothes that appeared on the runway, because it was exciting. I mean, now everything is so accessible prematurely. Then it was really exciting. And I remember, like, I would plot out things I really wanted and have to, you know, wait for the sale at Maxfield when it was called Maxfield Blue, and wait for final reductions and pick up a Gautier piece or a Yoji piece or some Sprouse. I was always interested in clothes, and certainly very fortunate that my parents kind of felt they'd rather have me buy something nice on sale than, you know, Montgomery Ward, you know, pair of tough skin pants.
How did this turn into opening decades in 1997? I mean, had you been thinking about vintage for a while?
I wore vintage to my prom.
Oh, I
actually got my tux from Rita Watnick, who owns Lily AC.
Yes,
she had her store on 3rd Street next to Dupre Dance Academy, where I would occasionally take like tap or basic jazz, which I wish there were recordings of my horrible dance ability. But I bought a 1940s tux that I wore to the prom. You know, I think that was fairly progressive in 1987 when I graduated high school. So I was interested in vintage. And then through my music career of singing all through the early to mid 90s, I would thrift looking for men's clothes. Because I would be in, you know, Alamogordo, New Mexico, or Orlando, Florida, or Seattle, or Portland. And usually I was in like a 2-week gig where, you know, you did the first week to get the reviews and you did the second week to get an audience. So in between the gigs, I had to protect my voice, since I was it. There was nobody else to play me. I started to thrift, initially looking for men's clothing, and eventually kept finding women's, and I was just sending things to my parents. So their living room was filled with clothes at a certain point. And so, you know, I said a star was born at Fred Segal. Well, a store was born on the road, touring glamorously.
And then I guess you had a clientele from Theodore, or just from growing up in LA? Like, how did
Not really. You know, I opened on Melrose, a block and a half west of Fred Segal.
Okay.
And it was pretty barren then. The Art Deco building that I'm in had so many failed businesses over the course of many years. But I loved it appealed to me, and originally I was next to a bookstore in the building. Now I have the whole building, but I didn't really have a clientele. I had a mailing list because of my performing. So I had some people coming because of that, and I wasn't an interloper. And this was the thing that I think really helped me launch the business. I was a native of LA. I was a guy. I wasn't mean. I wasn't crazy. I mean, that crazy. I was, you know, relatively young. I was 27 when the store opened, which now seems completely ancient when you look at someone like Billie Eilish, which she's accomplished at 18. And I also had a very fresh perspective for vintage. I wanted everything to look modern. So the store was really edited. The collection was extremely edited. It was very 60s and 70s focused. Mm-hmm. And people found the store. And one person in particular was profoundly impactful on the store, and that was Richard Buckley, Tom Ford's partner and husband. Richard found the store and just started spreading the word, and all of a sudden, like, Lisa Eisner knew about it, and then Ronnie Sassoon was coming in, and of course Tom Ford was coming in, and people were enthusiastic to share about decades. It was really nice. And somebody I had gone to summer camp when I was 13 was writing for a LA publication. So, you know, within about 6 months, the store was starting to get both local and national press. It was the right time, because we were just starting to dress up again on the red carpet. Celebrities needed things that were unusual and one of a kind. I was the antithesis of, like, minimal boring, although I was very edited in what we were selling. You know, this was the time of Calvin Klein slip dresses and and Helmut Lang. And here you could come to Decades and get something folkloric by Yves Saint Laurent. Yeah. So, you know, it was color, it was, and it was glamour, but it wasn't costume, which was very different from a lot of the other stores.
Did you ever have any advice from anybody else that did this, or did you just make it up as you went along?
I kind of really made it up. I didn't know what I was doing. I still don't know what I'm doing. I always say we built the business with thank you notes. So I really tried to do things in a very old school kind of way.
Yeah.
As you know, retail, you're only as good as the last sale you've had.
Right.
So, and of course, the last year has been the most complicated year of all of our lives, but thankfully we're still around. It was naivete, but also I was driven. I became very social in the community of my clients.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was flying to Houston to go to, you know, the opening of the ballet, or, you know, going to New York for, say, Venice. And then I started going to Paris for couture. So I was kind of in the world of my clients. I was always, you know, the poorest person in that circle, but it helped, because people trusted me, and I hope they still do trust me.
And you knew where they were wearing these things. You understood the events, you understood their lifestyle. And I think it sounds like you also started to acquire things for them. Like if somebody said, I'm the chairperson of Save Venice, I need something amazing. And so you would spend the next year trying to find something, or did you already?
Exactly. I mean, for example, right now I'm helping a woman in San Juan Capistrano find her Mother of the Bride dress.
Right.
And it's not just something from Decades. You know, I work with a lot of other luxury brands. So I will pull things from, you know, things from Decades that are pre-loved. I mean, she basically needs, I don't know what the equivalent is of a trousseau for a Mother of a Bride, but she, you know, she needs everything.
Yeah.
I'm not a stylist, but I am just a trusted partner in the journey. And I love to shop with people. I've been helping a friend here in Boulder with editing her closet and updating her wardrobe. And it, you know, it's fun. It's not brain surgery, but, you know, I think as we're on the cusp of getting out of the, you know, most difficult 14 or 15 months of modern times, people are excited to start dressing up and socializing and being philanthropic and traveling. So I'm just trying to support these people on their journeys. And, you know, every so often I get to fly on someone's plane.
Do you think that this past year has been harder than 2008, 2009?
Oh yeah, 2008 and 2009 were easy.
Compared to, really?
Well, yeah, because, you know, LA did not get that affected. And we had a lot of, we still had our Hollywood business.
And you have probably had a lot of people selling stuff.
Yes. And then, and even 9/11 didn't affect us that much. I remember I was supposed to be in New York on 9/11. I ended up going to Toronto and getting stuck there, but I was supposed to do an in-store appearance at Barney's, where we had a vintage department for several years. And I had a major collection of YSL jewelry and ready to wear. And I couldn't be there, but even that month turned out well. And we, the day after, I think on 9/12, we had so many requests, editorial requests, because magazines still had a shoot.
Right.
And needed things. So we kind of were able to navigate through that. This has been, you know, just insane. You know, I always say that I, you know, used to always help people with procuring their couture. And now I'm like helping people with, you know, getting the best Aviator Nation hoodie and and which Uggs to buy. And
well, I mean, we have a store in California also, as you know, and I would say, I mean, it is a completely different world out there than it is here. Just the mood has been so different, and it's hard, really, really challenging.
You know, I flew back to LA on the 31st of May. I had been back east. Yeah, I was in complete shock, and I left LA the beginning of December. I went to Malibu to hang out, and then I came to Boulder. Malibu kind of felt a little bit more normal, but you know, LA has been so restricted and has had such, you know, just a failing in so many aspects of the pandemic that, you know, when I'm in Colorado, I kind of feel like I'm in a normal place.
Right.
Everyone has their masks on, but you go to a store and people are there and they're social distancing and people are buying clothes. In Aspen, people are buying clothes.
Yeah.
So LA people just sort of gave up.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the mood was so completely different, just emotionally, just more taxing, I think, than where we are.
No, but interestingly enough, I did a couple projects with a luxury brand in LA of dealing with their VVIP clients, like in October and November, and people were shopping, but I think it was beyond just shopping. It was about desperation to have community and conversation.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the beauties of brick and mortar retail that can't be replicated online.
No.
That people want that community. And I think, you know, for us, like as independent retailers and people who are really hands-on with our clients, who I think we would both call our clients part of our extended family.
Yeah.
I think that there is such a desire for it. So we're inching back to it.
I want to talk a little bit about your book, Decades. Tell me about the process of that. Was that something you wanted to do, or did a publisher reach out? Was it something you'd always wanted to do?
I was on my way with a friend to the Nancy Reagan retrospective at the Ronald Reagan Library. And I was there with my friend, Gene Stein, who's a great writer, who wrote the Edie Sedgwick book. Uh-huh. And she's sort of going, oh, and her father had been a pallbearer at Ronald Reagan's funeral. So the strong family ties. Yep. She's about as politically opposite as Reagan. So she's like, I can't believe we're going here. And like, oh my God, this is so ridiculous. And you have to write a book. On the way there, she calls her literary agent. And within about 2 weeks, there's a bidding war for this book. And it finally came out 5 years later.
And did you enjoy the process? What was it like?
It was very interesting because Bloomsbury, that published the book, was very clear that this had to be a classic book that would get printed over and over again, of which it has. And they had a reference of a book that they had published on cooking called, I think it was the Big Fat Duck book, which had been a phenomenal success as an oversized, expensive book.
Right.
So it was not a rushed process. I worked with Rebecca DiLiberto, who wrote with me, and we would get together every Sunday and I would, you know, we'd have some Mediterranean food and talk about fashion and just record everything I said.
Right.
And then we came up with the concept of a chapter for each decade and then the dualities of, you know, is it Betty Page or Grace Kelly? It's both that are happening in one decade. And then we turned in, you know, more or less the manuscript, and then the research was done for the artwork. The copy had to be adjusted, and then the book gets designed, so captions had to be made. So it was an extremely long process. I just can't believe that I'm still doing book signings.
I know.
At some point, I'd like to write a follow-up to Decades about, you know, fashion in the 21st century, but it's not easy to do a good coffee table book. It's really easy to do a mediocre one,
yeah,
but to do a good one is a lot of work.
But you're proud of what you produced.
I am proud of it. Yeah. I just need to write another book, and I didn't get a Pulitzer. So.
And speaking of fashion history, I mean, that's a huge part of what you do. Is it all self-taught, and is it recent, or is it just your whole life you were interested in it, in fashion history? Because you couldn't do what you do without knowing a lot.
Right. I mean, I read a lot of books. I have a pretty large collection of fashion history books, but I do my fabrics because of UCLA and costume design, and I had some concept of construction. I mean, of course I was better at hand sewing than machine sewing. I mean, my huge petit main were better at more couture techniques. And I was fortunate that I grew up, you know, with access to things that were happening in the 80s and 90s in fashion. So I was very familiar with that. I just learned a lot over a couple of years, but I'm not a definitive fashion historian. I'm not a Hamish Bowles, you know, who's just like a genius. I have a good eye and I can identify things pretty quickly, but I think that my niche was really more about finding the modernity in the past and undiscovered designers and making things accessible. I love storytelling. So yeah. I'm just like this hybrid, weird person. person who's just, you know, trying to figure out how to retire.
Well, but I also think having the history of working in retail and understanding that you also have to sell these things, you have to look at them through a different lens there, because I think that they have to still be flattering. They have to make you feel beautiful in order to sell. And that's a pretty specific niche in itself.
That's a really good point, because I think, you know, a lot of vintage stores, you know, people would buy things for the fantasy of it. I was always buying things for the selling of it. And, right. And I still work that way. And sure, I have some things that we've had for 22 years that still haven't sold. So it continues to be a challenge.
You found your way back into entertainment through the Dukes of Melrose on Bravo, and then hosting QVC, and then Halston. Can you talk to me about this next chapter? And all the way through, you still have decades, correct?
Yes, so I still have the story. You know, I got sort of cornered to do the reality show for Bravo. So, you know, I did that.
And what was that like?
Incredibly disruptive, and had absolutely no benefit to my career, to be perfectly honest. The book was the best thing I ever did.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's interesting.
It's just not on brand for me. I'm not a Bravo, you know, I'm not that kind of personality.
Yeah.
I'm getting pitched a travel show right now. Like, okay, that's much more me. And the project with Halston and QVC was, you know, just a wonderful mix, because Halston is the closest to the personal style I love on people. So the DNA and the codes of the brand meant so much to me. And for years, headhunters would ask me, like, what would you like to work on? What brand? I was like, Halston. So it came to me. And for 5 years, it was incredible to have the relationship with the QVC community, as well as our brick and mortar business and online business. I loved it. Now I'm just ready to do some, you know, what the next thing is. And there's some really interesting projects that when I finally surrendered to the chaos of the world in December of last year,
like,
things started to happen. So, you know, now my cup runneth over with opportunities. And I'm most excited about, you know, spending a month in Hawaii and, you know, bringing a little bit of decades and sustainable chic to the island of to Kona. So that's going to be a really cool project.
You've had such a full, as we've heard, an eventful career. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the biggest challenges and the setbacks were along the way?
Well, I'd say the biggest challenge retail-wise was, you know, having to sue my ex-business partner for embezzlement, fraud, and other nefarious activities. It's just, you know, unfortunately, all too common.
Yeah.
It just was a reminder that it's hard to trust people.
Yeah.
And I'm a very trusting person. And, you know, then I had a similar experience with a manager at the store who, you know, was helping me clean up a mess. And of course, this person decided to dip their hands into the pot. So those have been the biggest challenges, just because it just, you know, disappointment in people's character. And I mean, I'm the type of person who I wouldn't take a quarter out of my own register to put money in the meter without, like, putting a slip in. Like, I'm just, like, to this day, I mean, I own the business 100% now. I own the building 100% now, but I'm not going to steal from my own business. I'm very, very much into transparency. So that has been the biggest challenge. I'm very blessed to have a good team in place right now. You know, I have played hooky from my store since the beginning of December, and everyone has been pretty sensitive to that. And kind of, you know, I mean, it's because it had been a really difficult year. My father passed away, and, you know, I just was dealing with a lot of things that I needed, you know, to take care of myself. But I've been able to do things remotely. I say that's the hardest thing.
And is there anything you wish you'd done differently? Or, I mean, is the lesson in it all the best part about it? And
well, I mean, like, the lesson sucks.
I think the lesson of just not trusting people sucks. I mean,
it's terrible. I wish I had listened to a handful of people who said, I don't think you should go into business with this person.
Yeah.
We don't trust this person. And, you know, I'm very much like Switzerland. I never speak poorly about people. Do you know Diane Pernay, who does A Shaded View of Fashion? Yeah. So, I mean, Diane used to call me Norway. I'm like, Diane, it's Switzerland.
So, I think Norway's neutral too.
and Natasha Fraser Cavassoni, like one of my favorite people on the planet, she calls me choir boy because I don't talk poorly about people.
Yeah.
And you know, I've realized that I don't have to talk poorly about people, but I need to trust my instinct and listen to other people's instincts a little bit more.
I loved reading a quote from you in the beginning of the pandemic in Women's Wear Daily that said, "I've never tried to be everything to everyone. That's a lesson a lot of brands will learn now." And I love that so much. How do you think that the pandemic has shifted fashion?
Well, I'm horrified by every brand choosing to become athleisure. You know, like, that is not going to get people back into stores.
No.
There is a fine line. But it's been interesting to see the brands that have stayed very much in their own kind of world. And some of those brands probably have the luxury of a big backing who can ride out a storm for, you know, 16 months or so.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look at historically during the Depression, during World War II, obviously things changed, but fashion still provided a fantasy. It's like, I love in Rachel Felder's book about red lipstick, it's like, they never banned red lipstick during World War II.
Yeah.
They made it available. So I think the reaction to everyone becoming a homebody and every brand becoming, not every brand, but so many brands becoming homebody brands, how are they going to transition out of it? And for those brands who have had roaring success through the pandemic in their casual attire and you know, stretchy and knits, I think the consumer is going to really do a 180 and want structure and you know, that kind of reaction, what happened with the roaring 20s after the last pandemic. So I think a lot of these, you know, and I've been working with a lot of these comfort brands who have just like kicked butt over the last year and grew, mm-hmm. but the thing I keep asking them, it's like, what's going to happen when people don't want to wear things like this because it represents like the dark age?
Right.
So I am curious what fashion will look like. I mean, I can see myself wearing a jogger pant. It's actually very Armani. I think Armani is sort of like where we're going to go, like the heyday of Armani.
Because, yeah, like Richard Gere Armani, right?
Exactly. To me, like, you put on a pair of Armani, gorgeous fabric, drawstring pants, but they're real pants. With a dress shirt and an unconstructed blazer, and it's still comfortable, but it's polished. And so, you know, ironically, I've been looking for all this like vintage Armani, and I bought some vintage Emporio Armani recently when I was in Dallas. But that's what I think it's going to look like. I mean, certainly couture will probably be so over the top. Yeah, I know. I mean, what do you think?
I agree and I disagree in that I do think, you know, when you look at the 20s, roaring 20s, those dresses were bias cut, you know, hair was short pixie. I do think there are things that will stay. I mean, I think people have been actually comfortable for the first time in many years. And so I think it'll be ultra luxurious, but I think it will be comfortable. So it could be, you know, back to your Halston or Zara, like those cashmere long sleeve gowns knit, you know, with crystal buttons. And
exactly. It just has to be the luxe version of it. And I think for brands that it's not part of their DNA, it's just been so wrong. I mean, I sort of feel like shocked when I get these email blasts of like what a brand is doing. It's like, I don't want that from you.
I know, exactly. I know we had a kind of a stand down with a designer this week, and we were just kind of like, I mean, if you want to try to sell it here, you're welcome to try, but there's no way we can sell this. Mm-hmm. Speaking of, you are part of our special retail mini series. Talk to me a little bit about what you think the future of retail looks like.
Wow. I've been thinking about this since like March 16th.
Right, exactly.
Of last year.
I was going to say, yeah, 2020.
As far as e-com and digital shopping, I think that it's going to become much more service-based.
Yeah, so it's what you've always done.
Yes, so it's like it's so everything's going to have to be service, service, service. Whether you're shopping on an app, it just can't feel anonymous. I mean, for example, everybody loves Apple Pay because it's easy. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like Apple Pay makes consuming easy, but Apple Pay doesn't address what you're actually purchasing and helping you understand how it fits and feeling the fabric. Because we have such a problem with people consuming and buying stuff online and buying three sizes of something. There's so much waste going on.
Gross.
The biggest thing I would say, first of all, is that we're going to buy less, more better.
Yeah.
So I think that e-com has to figure out how to decrease the amount of waste and high return rates.
Yeah.
Finally, I think it's a great moment to be an independent. It's a great moment to sell something that's one of a kind, that's not ubiquitous.
Yeah.
I bought in Dallas a little LV crossbody, like messenger bag, because I thought it was cool. But I was as excited about the early 80s linen high-waisted pants I found at my friend's store, Vintage Martini.
Right. You know,
so it's like that. It's like we have to find a way to make things a little mysterious and make discovery part of the process of fashion, because having things be too accessible and too ubiquitous makes it boring and uninteresting. And fashion is about discovery and playing dress up and the costume changes and how your personality and carriage changes when you put something on. So it's going to be a hybrid between virtual and in person.
And then what do you think about the role of vintage in the future of fashion? Because it really is the most sustainable fashion model there is.
Yes, it is the only truly sustainable. But I mean, I think it will continue to grow. And obviously the lines are getting more blurred as to when something is vintage, because now it's, you know, something that's 2 or 3 years old. People want to call vintage when it's really archival. My concern about vintage is that there's a lot of big players exploiting it.
Yeah.
Again, when something gets too accessible, it loses its cachet. And I don't want that to happen to vintage. Like, I don't want vintage to become Tommy Hilfiger when he's built a great business. But you know what I mean? Like, I don't want there to be vintage departments in every single store. And vintage, it's like, it still has to feel special.
Yeah.
For the same reason luxury retail has to feel special.
Yeah. I mean, and let the pros like you do it, the people who've done it for, you know, 25 years and know what you're doing, I guess.
Exactly.
What do you envision for yourself in the next 2 years? What's the future of Cameron and Decades?
Well, you know, I think Decades has to figure out how to own a type of retail that we help develop, which is, you know, this vintage luxury retail. So I have to figure out how we can build it and scale the business, but do it with intention and good faith. At the same time, I'm very interested in traveling the Decades concept. So doing these pop-ups around the country, not just with vintage, but with other sustainable brands. So to really give the customer the ease to procure the pieces that they know in good consciousness have been vetted by me, and to get that kind of head to toe, clean, eco, green fashion look. So that's something I'm going to be experimenting with in May.
Great.
And you know, working on a couple new platforms. I'm very interested in a couple new e-com platforms that are being developed, and I'm doing some kind of guidance on, and we'll see if any of them get the funding they need so that I can finally make some money.
We touched on it earlier, but I want a much better, longer description about what you wore to the prom.
So my prom look was a navy 1940s tail tuxedo with a red satin super 1987 bow tie.
That sounds gorgeous.
There was a limousine and I had two dates.
All right. That's a first.
I don't remember the shoes. The only thing I really remember about the prom is that the after prom, I got really sick. It was at the Palace on Vine, north of Sunset. Uh-huh. And everyone thought I had done like tons of drugs. And I was like this total less than zero moment. And it absolutely wasn't. It was the chicken Kiev. Yeah, it was like, exactly. It was like so sad. No, I'm barfing because of the food. That's why I haven't had it since.
Have you? Yeah, I bet you really haven't. Have you?
Oh, no, seriously, never.
Cameron, thank you so much.
You're welcome. This was fun.